I'm Commander Shepard, and this is my favorite lorecast on the Citadel.
Welcome to the Mass Effect Lorecast, the podcast where we explore the vast lore behind the Mass Effect games. Spectres, welcome back to the Mass Effect Lorecast. This is your host, Tom, or Robots. I'm here with my good buddy, Sam, and Seven, the legend. Sam, it's an exciting episode. This is a fun day.
It is. We have another special guest with us, and, you know, you've surely seen his work throughout the Mass Effect games. John Eppinger joins us on the show. Welcome, John, and thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
John, welcome. We're so excited to talk to you. And this is the first opportunity we've had to talk with a developer, somebody who's actually worked behind the scenes other than in a voice acting capacity, somebody who has a lot to do with the foundations of these series of games that we enjoy so much. Can you just start us off and give people a little bit of your background and how you've been involved in the series?
Yeah, absolutely. I started at BioWare in 2007, right when Mass Effect 1 was wrapping up. Previously to that, I'd always been interested in storytelling, spent a lot of money on a theater degree, which is very lucrative, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
And I was looking for ways to make money through storytelling, and ended up making some little machinima videos using the World of Warcraft engine. And those got noticed by some people at BioWare applied there. And my brother and I actually got hired as a team since we've been making those videos together.
Awesome.
So yeah, we went up there right when Mass Effect 1 was wrapping up, and then we worked on Dragon Age Origins. And then after that, I moved on to Mass Effect 2.
That's awesome. I remember the days of the World of Warcraft machinima stuff showing up in early YouTube videos, like this era of stuff. That's amazing.
I remember that too. Yeah, that was YouTube was a different world back then. And I also feel like some of the machinima content was better back then than some of the stuff I see now, like on average.
It's entirely possible. Yeah, this was like pre-monetization YouTube. So it was basically, there was a group of us, the machinima community, just making movies for fun. And there were a couple online contests that had some low-level prizes. But yeah, at the time, it was a bunch of scrappy people that wanted to tell stories. As far as why the content might be a little rougher these days, I know that the industry actually hired a bunch of people like myself. So a lot of talent got pulled straight into the industry. So we left machinima, but you got to experience our work officially. So,
and speaking of your work, now you worked on the cinematics for Mass Effect. Is that right?
Yeah. I was part of the what was called the cinematic design team. And BioWare at the time had kind of two separate cinematic tracks. One was the cinematic animation team, which were the really highly skilled, highly talented keyframe animators who were doing all the really cool starship battles and stuff that was really high octane and really high fidelity. And then there was a group of cinematic designers like myself who were in charge of all the interactive elements. So basically any time there was a choice wheel involved, we were handling those scenes, and we got to do a lot of really, really awesome stuff as well. But we were not keyframe animators. We had a different workflow.
This is a universe of things that, unless you've been involved in it, you don't really know a whole lot about how that stuff works. I do recognize the term keyframe from the little bit of animation stuff that I've looked into and those kinds of things. But this is not my area of expertise. It's really cool to hear things from your perspective. When you started out, what was your title, and then as you moved on in the company, did your title change? Have you had different official roles or titles?
Yeah. I think I got brought on as, I think, an associate cinematic designer, and then that moved up to just straight up cinematic designer was the next level. And then by the time I left BioWare, I was a senior cinematic designer. And then above that, there would be, you know, leads. And then eventually BioWare introduced a director level roles as well.
Wow.
So yeah, there would usually be a lot of cinematic designers, a couple of lead cinematic designers, and some associates, and even I think assistant was kind of the entry level for people that had a lot of passion but not necessarily a lot of skill. So there were, at that time, yeah, there was kind of like four tiers of cinematic designer, I think.
Yeah, that tracks. It seems like things are like that in a lot of different kinds of companies or corporations, where you have the different tiers and different levels depending on your experience. So, if you're actually down in when you're getting your hands dirty, when you're down in the muck and you're working on this, what does a regular day look like in the life of a cinematic designer?
Yeah, it looked like he had too much work to do.
Right.
That was one of the key things. Because, yeah, again, we were the ones in charge of the kind of 40 hours of interactive content, which no player ever sees all 40 hours of branching content in a Bioware game. But we would handle about, 96% of that. And then the cinematic animators would handle a much smaller portion. And their stuff tended to be more what we would call critical paths. So there would be less branching involved.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a role to play in figuring out what those scenes would be? Or were they written and scripted by a different group and then you did the animation? Or did you have feedback on what they should look like and how they should play out?
Yeah, that kind of evolved over the course of my career at BioWare, even starting before I did. When cinematic design was first kind of introduced as a discipline at BioWare, they didn't have a lot of control at all. As I understand it, again, on Mass Effect 1, it was mostly they were handed scripts and said, hey, execute on this as best you can. And they could, give some feedback and work with writers, of course. But everybody was moving at very, very high velocity and always is. So there's wasn't always a lot of time to go back and like say, hey, this script, can we change some things up to maybe make it more dramatic or more high intensity? But no, it was always there's a fully staffed writing team that would handle writing all the scripts. And then at least early in my career, for the first couple games, it was very much we show up, somebody hands us a level, and the scripts as they get written get past us, and then we do all the animation and camera work and the blocking and all the cinematic parts.
Cool. Yeah, I can imagine how that would evolve and how that conversation might change from game to game as you become more and more familiar with the way the scenes have played out previously and all of that. Sam, did you have a question?
Yeah. So, John, I want to ask, can you describe for our listeners what the environment was like working on Mass Effect back then? We know the voice actors rarely got to work physically in the same places together for scenes. Was that the case for your team on Mass Effect? Did you travel for work? What was it like day to day?
We didn't travel much at that point. It was basically all the cinematic designers in a room together. There were about 10 of us on Mass Effect 2. And yeah, we were all just kind of crammed in there. So you were with your peers and we could all look over each other's shoulders and kind of exchange ideas and information. I think there might have actually been two rooms for us for Mass Effect 2, because the BioWare office in Edmonton was a bunch of small rooms. They later knocked down a bunch of walls and made larger rooms. But yeah, we never got a chance really to interact with the voice over actors. That was another department would talk to them, run them through the script and direct them through the voiceover. And then we would, get that voiceover at some point. We could make requests, like if we, blocked out a scene, it was like, the way I've got this set up, like Shepard's really in this person's face. Like, can we, have them give us a more aggro read on this? And if there was time, that department was always happy to go back and try to get that for us. But there were also other times where, the VO would come in and it's like, all right, that's what I got to work with. So now I have to adjust some things on my end to fit the performance with what the vocals are.
So there was a two-way street of communication between the voice acting team and your team. It wasn't just a one-way dynamic.
It grew into that. And again, this was kind of across the board with the writers and everybody. As cinematic design kind of grew a little bit more established at BioWare, and we were able to kind of put our mark on more content, kind of show what we could do if we were given access to some things earlier on and make it a little bit more of a two-way street. We were able to get really, really good results. So it was never a fully two-way street, but it became a lot more like that. But at the end of the day, again, it was all about like, hey, we've got a week to get this done. So there is no time for much discussion. It's just kind of the content must flow.
Yeah, just got to get it done. Hey, I've got a kind of off the cuff question. When you were working on animation stuff, as with many games, there are clearly scenes where you see the animations of the in-game assets, like the ones that you move around and affect, and then there are scenes where the assets improve in quality. And you described a little bit this at the beginning. Is most of what you did using the in-game assets? Or how does that work? Were you working in the game engine itself, or were you scripting things using a different software?
Great question.
Yeah, no, we were always in-game. Cinematic design we're always in the real-time engines. So we were working directly in Unreal. The cinematic animators would be working in 3ds Max at the time, I believe, or Maya, again, doing the keyframe animation and then importing things into Unreal. But no, we were always fully in real-time. And the engine. And yes, we were, again, we couldn't create bespoke animations ourselves. We couldn't the script calls for Shepard to reach up onto this shelf and pluck something off of it and then throw it over to a henchman. We would have to say like, okay, the script's asking for that. I have this animation library of things that had been built over the course of several projects. And a lot of it was gameplay stuff. So you'll see a lot of combat animations in our work that are just directly ripped out of the gameplay library. And then we did eventually get some small budget to motion capture some unique stuff ourselves and to kind of build some of the pose sets that we would use, because we'd always be working off stuff like there's arms crossed and standing neutral and step forward, these different pose sets.
The ones you see over and over again, and once you've played the game enough times.
Exactly. Yeah. All the Mass Effect fans and the Dragon Age ones as well have seen all these many, many times, and even cross franchises. We had a limited set of poses and then a limited set of what we would call gestures that would be like little arm things and head things on top of those. And it was our job to take those kind of Lego bricks of animation and build a performance stacking them on top of each other.
I got to ask.
Go ahead.
The Shepard shuffle. Was that bespoke?
That was bespoke. Yeah, that's motion capture. That was one that we purposefully kept in the library because people loved it, and you couldn't replace that with something. I think it's canon that Shepard is a pretty bad dancer.
That's great.
That's pretty great. Who was that? Do you know or do you remember who the actual model was for the mocap? It wasn't Mark Meer, was it?
No. This was all the motion capture was done offsite, and no, certainly on a Mass Effect 1, 2, and 3, we didn't have the capability to have the actors themselves come and do the motion capture. So it would be somebody else, a stunt actor or a specific motion capture actor. I believe most of the capture was done out of Vancouver,
or just Jimmy in accounting. Hey, Jimmy, we need you to do a funny dance. All right.
No, luckily we got somebody more specialized in that. But there were a couple times where I know like an animation lead would go to capture something, and if the actor wasn't doing it right, then the animator would jump in the suit and act it out themselves. So there are some developer animations in there, I think, but most of them were paid professionals who were specifically talented at that.
I'm going to be on the lookout now. So, speaking of that, from a player's perspective, we know that you worked on the interactive dialogue scenes. Which scenes might a player remember that you can point to, and or maybe you see these posts on Reddit, right, of like gameplay, and which of those scenes can you point to and say, hey, I did that? And keep in mind, we are really some super fans on this podcast, so there is no such thing as too obscure of a reference for us.
Yeah. And I will also say that I can't remember everything because it has been many, many years now. And I'm afraid the old memory is as good as it used to be. But on Mass Effect 2 specifically, I did a lot of work with the henchmen on the Normandy. So I like all the relationship dialogues. I did all of Tally's dialogues, Grunt, and Thane and Legion and Morden. There were five of them. Was that five?
I wasn't counting, but maybe.
Admittedly, I wasn't counting.
I was
either.
Picturing each of them in my mind as you went over them, trying to like visualize
it. Telly, Thane, Grunt, Legion, and Morden. Yeah, I did all the Normandy conversations with them when you're getting to know them, and when they're locked in their rooms and can't go anywhere. That was me as well. All of their relationship dialogues had to be in the same room where they lived.
Does that include the romance scenes as well?
The final romance scenes, those were handled by the cinematic animator. So yeah, as soon as it became smoochy time, then that was somebody else. But everything up until then, I was in charge of for those characters.
Smoochy time is very important. On a similar note, you have very different body types among, you know, some like Tally on one hand and then Grunt on another. Was it awkward trying to animate different models, being that there's such a variety in size and shape?
Absolutely. And that was one of the key things, again, when we were building these pose and gesture sets, we had to be very conscious of certain characters having limitations, like the Krogan stubby arms, and they yeah. hunch over a lot. But the animation team did a great job of using, I believe it was additive animations to kind of make a lot of that stuff work. But we had to be very conscious of, you know, you could put an animation on a character and the animation where Shepard touches his forehead, if I use that on Grunt, his hand goes through his face.
Yeah.
So I need to not use that animation, or do some tricky stuff with the camera, or some additive bone masking. And so we had a couple tools to alter some stuff on the fly. But yes, it did not all work out of the box for all characters. It was a pain at times.
I think this is kind of surprising, at least for me, and I think it will be for a lot of other Mass Effect players who don't know a lot about development of games and how that works. Because for me, I'm like just learning for the first time that, like, and it sounds so, I don't know, stupid or like coming from a neophyte that like, there were all of these limitations that you and your team had to work in. And like, I guess it just makes Mass Effect that much more impressive because you had to play the hand you were dealt, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was kind of Cinemac Design's mandate specifically. And again, why BioWare Cinemac Design ended up hiring so many machinima makers was it was all about, you've got limited or in some cases zero resources, what can you build and make an amazing scene? So you had to look at these animations and be like, all right, so that's a guy like kneeling down. If I put the camera over here, can I make it look like he's, you know, kneeling and grabbing something off the ground, even though we don't have an animation for that? How can I utilize all this stuff to use the player's imagination to tell the story that is being called for in the script? And I wish I could say that, you know, we were showered with money and animation resources, but it was very much scrappy MacGyver type stuff. But that was also very, very fulfilling, because when you could pull off something, you were like, I don't even know how I made that look real. It should not look real with what I was slapping together. But yeah, that's a pretty convincing walk and talk of this character going down this hallway and gesturing and talking and rounding a corner. And that was always supremely satisfying. You were able to put together something you didn't think you'd be able to.
Yeah. Well, half his body has clipped through things that the camera just didn't happen to notice and all of that. Is there a specific scene that you have in mind where you feel like, oh my God, I totally made this work, and nobody knows that we really like rigged it in a way where if you just move the camera around, you'd be like, oh my God, that doesn't look like it works at all.
I mean, the sad thing is like basically everything.
About
half of it, if you pull the camera out, it looks broken as heck. I'm trying to think. I had on Dragon Age 2, not Mass Effect, I spent a week trying to drown someone in a very shallow pool of water, and I eventually managed to get it to work, and I was very proud of that. Nothing specific comes to mind, I'm afraid, but it's all very broken.
Right. So speaking of like moving from one game to another, you have Mass Effect 1, and then in Mass Effect 2, there's the vibe is much more action hero-y. If the cinematics feel different from 1 in a, I don't know if they're more polished or just more dramatic or more cinematic. Do you have an idea for why that might be?
Yeah. And it's a combination of a lot of things. So Mass Effect 1 was kind of Cinematic Design's first real crack at having a strong mandate to make a real cinematic game. There had been a couple cinematic designers on previous projects. But Mass Effect 1 was the one where BioWare said, hey, we are going to make a cinematic game, not just in, you know, an hour or two of hand animated stuff, but with all these branching dialogues we've always had. So they made a very small cinematic design team. I think there were only four or five of them on Mass Effect 1. And again, had a very limited palette of resources and animation and tools for like camera work and all that sort of stuff. And then for Mass Effect 2, they said, hey, that worked out great. Let's give more resources. So more manpower was one. Again, there were, I think there were 10 or 11 cinematic designers on Mass Effect 2. So that at least like, you know, doubled the amount of hours we could throw at that content. Another thing was, again, specifically just kind of like dialing in on the art of cinematography for that branching content, seeing that it could be done to a certain quality level on Mass Effect 1. Now, Mass Effect 2 for the sequel, what can we do to really ramp up the artistry and the quality of those? There was a specific mandate inside the cinematic design team to just do more complicated and better stuff than than they'd done on the first game. And then there were a lot of structural things as well, just in the way the interactive dialogues are structured. And again, the layman never sees this stuff, but a lot of early BioWare dialogues, as I understand it, were they would always kind of like loop back on themselves. And there would be investigate hubs that would, sorry, I'm getting into some really nerdy terminology, game dev terminology here. But you could start a scene and get halfway through it and then have a line that would take you back to the beginning of the scene, which would mean that if you were trying to like block it out so that they were starting sitting at a table and then they get up and walk over to a door and then go out into a hallway, you can't do that if there's a choice that takes you back to the first line
because it needs to be a loop
at the table.
Yeah.
But by the time Mass Effect 2 came around, there was a decision again to make these scenes more cinematic and more like dramatic scenes in a movie or a TV show that had, you know, structured beginning, middle, and end. And so there would still be investigate loops inside that, but the writing team would structure them so that they could have dramatic, cinematic, and blocking progression throughout the scene. So you could do that stuff where you start the scene sitting at the table. And then Thane would get up, you know, go over to his weapons cabinet, look at it, stand there for a lot of the dialogue. And then I would just need to get him back in his chair at the end. But there was a good chunk of time where I could move him away from that initial position and know that a choice wouldn't try to loop you back to a part where he was supposed to be somewhere else.
And go ahead. I think we're about
pretty natural.
Yeah, we're saying the same thing. Yeah, like from a
very kind. From a
viewer's perspective, the way the animations play out, especially once you get to two, feel more natural. There's that, like, you don't necessarily notice that, like, oh well, they had to go back to the other part because of the dialogue options and those kinds of things. You're engaged with the story and the dialogue and what's happening, and it takes you away from the mechanics of the moment, I think. So,
and it was in 2010. And like, you know, I remember I was like a day one player for Mass Effect 2. And I remember in 2010, like playing through these cinematics and the dialogue choices and being like so immersed because it was Mass Effect 2 was set apart from so many other games at the time. And I wanted to ask John, you know, what do you think about Mass Effect 2's storytelling through cinematics? Was it that set it apart from other games at the time?
Again, I think it was that the company made a conscious decision to throw more bodies at this problem. I know like the Witcher 1 came out in a similar time frame, and they were just kind of like starting their own cinematic design program. And you could see a marked difference between like Witcher 1 dialogues and Mass Effect 2 dialogues. And I know we were certainly like, all right, awesome. We are killing it. We are pushing things forward. We are putting more quality into these compared to them. But, you know, by the end of Witcher 3, like, boy, howdy, they were, you know, neck and neck with us, if not kicking our tuchuses at the end of Mass Effect 3. But it just shows that any company, if you apply the right resources, you can get that kind of progression. You just have to commit to it.
Yeah, I would say that the jump from Witcher 1 to Witcher 3 was gigantic. Because even like Mass Effect 1 compared to Witcher 1, Mass Effect 1 like way better than the cinematics from The Witcher 1. It was like that game felt like an indie project as opposed to a AAA game, right? But by the time you hit Witcher 3, they've definitely caught up, and then now you're kind of neck and neck. Sam, do you have another one you wanted to ask?
Yeah, you know, speaking of the third game in a trilogy, from Mass Effect 2 to 3, we really see a difference as players in tone. You know, it's much heavier, it's more solemn, there's so much more gravitas. And the best way on like a third grade level that I can put this is, you know, it's less like Michael Bay directed it and more like Christopher Nolan did. And how did that difference in tone translate to your work? Like, are there any examples you can remember?
Yeah, I mean, from a very high level, it was, you know, the Mass Effect trilogy has an arc. You know, the first one's much more about exploration and, you know, kind of discovery. And then you get into kind of some horror elements in two, where you're starting to see what the Reapers are and the repercussions. And then by three, it's the full on apocalypse. You know, literally the genocide is the word of the day. You know, the Reapers are out there, you know, cleansing entire planets. So that definitely, at the core, like, it just has an impact on the scripts, what the writers are writing. And then the cinematic team, you know, we follow in their footsteps and look at the content. And we will, any cinematic artist worth their salt, if you give them something highly emotionally impactful, like, you know, tragedy, we will chomp at the bit to just knock that out of the park. You want to do something that has high emotional content. So if you're saying, hey, this is the end of the world, all of these people are suffering and, you know, trying to live their lives as best they can during this time, you can't help but step up to the plate and have that, you know, drive every time you're looking at a shot. Like, how can I express that Shepard has the weight of the universe on their shoulders at this moment? Like, this is not a fun thing that we're doing in Mass Effect 3. This is the survival of sentience in the universe.
Well, I mean, it opens up in that tone perfectly, you know, like from the very get-go with the leaving Earth sequence and the music just kills it too. With Shepard seeing the shuttle where the child is killed, and then the subsequent dialogue with James after walking on the Normandy, and you can tell that, like, for the first time in a long, like, maybe ever for the player having played this, Shepard is truly rattled and snapping at his own squad mates. And did you happen to work on that conversation with James, Shepard and James, right after they leave Earth?
I did not. No, I worked on some later stuff in Mass Effect 3. But that's exactly it. I think that was kind of the turning point where, you know, we were telling the player, hey, Shepard might not have this under control. Mass Effect 1 and Mass Effect 2, like, you know, there's some rough stuff in there, but in the end, the hero is going to prevail. Mass Effect 3, there was no guarantee.
And speaking of later stuff, you know, we've been talking a lot about Morden on this podcast in the past couple weeks. And I think you had a hand in some of the scenes about the final curing of the Genophage, right?
I did. As I mentioned on Mass Effect 2, I'd done all of Morden's dialogues in the Normandy, and as part of that, I got to do the fantastic musical number that he sang. That's still one of the highlights of my career. I remember I read the script for that, And I think I had a day to do the entire dialogue that has that inside it. And I read the musical number. And again, I have a theater degree, so I was a little bit of a musical theater nerd myself. So I was like, I am going to throw everything I have at making sure this song is super cool with the limited time I have. So I spent half of my full day that I had for that dialogue just on the three lines that he sings. But as part of that, when Mass Effect 3 rolled around, they'd already been working on it while I was, up on, working on Dragon Age, 2 at the time. And when I came down, you know, they were, kind of assigning who's doing what level, and the writer and the level designer who are working on, Genophage 2, that's the level that's the end of the Genophage campaign. They came up to me and they were like, hey, we were huge fans of what you did, with Morden on Mass 2. Do you want in on this level? And they kind of laid it out for me what was going to happen. And I was like, yes, please. I will do anything to work on this level. In fact, if my lead gives it to another one of my team members, I will have to stab them so that I can have this level, because it's incredible. Just, what they'd laid out, what they wanted to do, yeah, again, it's a dream to work on that that level of emotional payoff over that huge Genophage arc across the entire trilogy. And I loved Morden as a character from working on him, and to give him that sort of redemption and that finale to his arc. I couldn't pass that up at all. So yeah, I jumped at the chance to work on that.
And the blocking was for Morden, especially during that scene, is so it's so impactful, because it's not just, you know, it's not just impactful and dramatic, and it's tough for the players to watch a character that you perhaps love going to a certain death. But it's also perfect in my mind, because you can see the internal struggle within Morden throughout his arc. And he's this extremely cerebral person, right? And you see it a lot on the Normandy in Mass Effect 2, him pacing back and forth. And he's like shooting ideas basically to himself back and forth in his head. And the cinematics kind of reflect that. But then as you get closer to Genophage 2, like you said, that the finality of this arc, he's doing less of that pacing. And he's more at peace.
Yeah.
And I like Tom and I say this a lot. Very few things in fiction are coincidence. And I assume that that was not a coincidence.
No. Tried to, again, that's the sort of thing that you kind of build in there and hope that it reads. But yeah, he was a changed character at that point in time. He had a lot. He kind of firmed up some ideas about his place and his role in the universe and in history, in my mind. And yeah, we tried to reflect that. Obviously the writers did a fantastic job in the writing. And I tried again, just to execute on that, with the blocking and the cinematography and in the animation. And when you're given such fertile ground as that content, you can just hope you don't mess it up and you do it right. And I like to think that I did a passable job at it. It was, it was a lot of work, and certainly my favorite, part to work on is not, most people might think that it's the kind of Paragon version where he goes up and he saves everybody and it's fantastic. I actually took a lot of pleasure in working on the Renegade version, where he goes up in a compromised state due to player actions. I knew we had to make that version of the scene so that the player had the option, but it was my personal goal that if you did my boy Morden dirty like that, I was going to emotionally shiv you as hard as I could. And make you watch every moment of him going up that elevator and what happens at the top of that tower. I poured everything I could into making you feel like a real jerk for doing that.
That was, well, you accomplished that mission 120%, because I've talked about this before on the Lorecast, but the Renegade like sequence of dialogue and the cinematics in that in Morden's fate is like one of the most gut-wrenching scenes in Mass Effect, and something I've never actually been able to bring myself to do, but I've seen YouTube videos of it. Mm-hmm. And yet when Shepard pushes Morden to the edge and Morden turns around and snaps and says, "I made a mistake." It's like, oh wow, holy shit. That was like some of the best, it was like the best culmination of dialogue, of background, lore and music and the cinematics. And it just, there's a beat in everything after that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you can ultimately shoot Morden. You know, I'm not worried about spoilers because the game's been out for a while, but man, you really did nail making that a guilt trip.
Thank you. You're very kind. And yeah, again, that was one of those moments. That line specifically, the "I made a mistake," that is, yeah, that's the linchpin of that scene. And that is one of those ones where we did go back and forth with the voice actor a couple times and get some alternate takes, so that they could, yeah, really match what I was trying to do visually there. And yeah, I think again, everybody, you know, executed perfectly. And yeah, that was that scene when, Shepard shoots Morden. One of the little Easter eggy things that I did build in, normally when Shepard pulls out a pistol throughout the trilogy, it's usually, a different gun. I think it's the Tempest was the name of it. But there's a pistol that generally Shepard uses throughout the entire trilogy. But if you pull the gun on Morden, I specifically made it the Carnifex that Morden gives you in Mass Effect 2.
Oh my God.
And then if you pay attention in the scene after Shepard shoots Morden with that, after Morden is in the elevator going up, there is a shot of Shepard throwing the Carnifex away in disgust before they walk out of the room. And that was a nice little nod to the history between them that we threw in that I really enjoyed.
Another little twist of the knife.
That's incredible. Exactly. Yeah, that's not just a twist. That's a thrashing of the knife.
Another stab.
You shoot him with the gun he gifted you with.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Biting the hand that feeds.
Yeah. Well,
you're a big old jerky jerk.
Big old jerky jerk. Well, we've got a whole bunch of other questions to get to, but we have to take a break here in order to thank our patrons. So don't go anywhere, because, man, this is super interesting stuff. We'll be right back.
Message coming in. Patching it through.
I am Sovereign, and this station is mine. I like the sound of that.
All right, here we are in the middle of the show, and we're going to do this quick in order to get back to the interview to get as much more time as we possibly can here. But we have to shout out our newest patron, Samuel R. Welcome to the Patreon. We appreciate the support. Thank you so much for being here. We're currently at 68 patrons, and we have to shout out our Shepherd tier patrons as well. Kokoshins, Edboy, Aaron J., Kira C., Lieutenant Tosino, That Spectre J., and William, thank you so much for all of your support. Normally, we'd read out some reviews and stuff, but we're going to cut that and put that on next week, because then we'll have more time for the interview. So let's get back to it. Here we go.
Spit it out, or are you trying to build suspense?
You're so dense, sir. Obviously, I do not know as much about human relationships as I thought.
All right, we're back. See, that didn't take too long. Sam, did you have any other follow-up questions on the Morden stuff?
You know, not about Morden's fate, but I did want to ask about other characters' ultimate fate. Did you work on any other characters' ultimate fate?
No, that was the main one I was focused on. Geno 2 is one of the biggest levels in the game, and I had two other smaller levels, but we tried really hard to spread out the really good stuff amongst the entire cinematic design team. Everything else, the other really good finales were handled by others. And again, the entire team crushed it. I mean, the Geth Corian finale is truly just one of the greatest moments in gaming, in my opinion. It's so well done by my colleague Zach Scott. And yeah, everybody on the team, again, all those scenes really, really crushed it. But I can only lay claim to the one.
There's still iterations of that Geth Corian war resolution that I'm seeing. Like, my partner just played through Mass Effect for the first time not long ago, and she got the ending of that Gethkorian resolution where Legion snaps on Shepard and picks Shepard up basically by the collar and is about to throw Shepard off the cliff. And I had never seen that before. I didn't even know that that animation was possible, honestly. And when I'm watching my partner play through this, I was like, holy shit, that was really intense.
Yeah. Yeah. And if I recall, is that the one where Tally comes up and stabs Legion in the back with her boot knife? I think that was the first time the boot knife came out, even though it had been on her model since Mass Effect 1.
I can't remember exactly how Legion dies, but Legion certainly gets taken out by Tally. And that was a heck of a scene. Let's talk about some other final scenes of Mass Effect 3. The beam run and the Citadel confrontation. Did you work on those, or work, I suppose, with close friends who did work on those?
Yeah, I didn't work on those specifically. I knew the people who did. It was a very, very small team. And it was pretty, that one was held pretty close to the vest. So I didn't see it until only, a month or so before the players did. I didn't have a whole lot to do that, but I know everybody who did was very, very passionate, and the people who led the franchise were extremely invested in it and had eyes on it every minute of every day. And I certainly don't envy that kind of eye on you from the higher ups. That's a lot of pressure. Again, everybody involved was very dialed in on what they were trying to do. And don't think they hit the marks as far as what the fans were expecting in a lot of regards. There were a lot of, budget time constraints. And all I know is the people who led the franchise were there every step of the way overseeing it.
Yeah. Sam, was there something else you wanted to ask?
Yeah, on the topic of the ending and then the extended cut, were you aware of any maybe talking with your coworkers of subtle differences between the different endings and the different extended cut explanations that inattentive players may have missed, like myself with that Carnifex Easter egg that you had brought up?
Nothing off the top of the head. All the extended cut stuff was done by the cinematic animation team. The cinematic designers, we were already on a DLC at the time, if I recall. I was kind of hands off on that. I was also, seeing some stuff on coworkers' screens, but I didn't have a lot of interaction with the people building that content when they were doing it. But I know that there was a very palpable sense that, that a lot of things that were left kind of up to the player's imagination in the original ending, and people had kind of assumed that, nobody looking at this, they'll know that, the sublight drives will get the Turians home. Nobody's going to starve on their way back to their galaxy, even if they were left on Earth without their agriculture ships. There were a lot of things that, again, I think the dev team thought that the players would come up with on their own, but certainly some of the assumptions that were made from the original ending surprised us. And they're like, oh, they thought that everybody starved to death after that? Like, oh, no, they still have engines. Even the Mass Effect relays are gone, but they can get home. Like, they got food on board.
Yeah. You've mentioned a few times responding to people's reactions after the games were launched, and you know how things kind of just take off on the internet. Some idea gets planted somewhere and then everybody rallies around it. What was it like being part of the team and just seeing everybody's reaction to the games after they launch?
It was great in general. Like I said, we were always so appreciative of the fans' response. It was obvious that the games, people love them, and they love the characters. They love the work that we were doing. And, we, at that time, most Bioware devs were putting in a lot of extra hours. There was a lot of crunch at that time because we were all so passionate about the projects. And a lot of us were young and dumb and didn't have real good work-life balance. and we're kind of, spending a lot of hours in the office. And so then seeing the player reactions, the critical response, yeah, it was really, really heartwarming and always fueled us on for the next project. And yeah, there were a lot of things, you know, we were always reading forums and, you know, once YouTube became a thing, watching reaction videos and all that stuff. And anytime, somebody can put out content that shows the dev how much that the work that we've done means to them, it is always so, so appreciated, because we do work in a vacuum for years running without any sort of feedback from the people who we're making this for. So you can, again, work your butt off for 3 years with no fuel to kind of keep that fire going other than what your coworkers give you. So when we do put out a product and people have that response, it really revitalizes us and makes it all worth doing, really, at the end of the day. We're doing it here to make stuff that you guys care about. And you know, the hope is always that every project we work on, no matter what character or no matter what franchise or what company you're with, you always want the gamers to be happy at the end of the day.
Yeah. On a similar note, to kind of follow up on that, did you have any sense at the time that we would be in 2023 and people would still be on their, you know, 10th playthrough of the games and still talking about it and listening to a podcast about it and all of that?
Probably not this far out. I mean, we felt like we were doing something special. The time that I was there on Mass Effect 2 and 3, definitely. But yeah, it's always, you know, media comes and goes and you never really know what's going to stick around for the long term. But I think just the fact that choices persisted across, you know, an entire trilogy, everybody knew how revolutionary that was. And that was to big. This day, again, yeah, it really has only been attempted by a couple other projects with good reason. It's really hard to do and it's really hard to do well. It takes a lot of resources and a lot of effort. And there's cheaper ways for game companies to make money than to commit to something as ambitious as that.
Yeah, it's very true. Sam?
With so many hours that you were putting in, and I work in a pretty demanding field as well, where, I mean, you're talking about being young and not having a good work-life balance. I'm living that right now, so that speaks to me. But that being said, I know in my own workplace, we have some running jokes that kind of, you know, ease the tension and get us through. Were there any running jokes among your team, maybe ones that we can see present in the game as Easter eggs or other things like that?
Yeah, a couple. I mean, obviously, like at some point, I Should Go, like, really took on its own momentum inside the dev team, even before probably everybody else, because again, we would pick up on it while we were building the stuff. So yeah, stuff like that would always come up. There would be little internal jokes. One that I really enjoyed was, there was a bug on Mass Effect 1 on the Citadel where there's a quest that you can't complete because there's like 10 keepers that you have to find on the Citadel or whatever. And one of them, there's a bug where the keeper will sometimes go missing. And so you can't actually complete the quest. And once that's locked into your save game, like, there's no way to fix it. I think what happened was, like, that NPC just, like, drops through the floor or something. If you load the different areas, if you, like, go into this room and then go into that room and then go into this room again, like, there's a very small period of time where the character will try to load when there's no floor for it. So it'll just, like, drop through and then be gone forever. And you'll never be able to find it.
Just falls out of the Citadel.
Somewhere someone is listening to this like, I freaking knew it.
Yeah, no, it's one that, yeah, people are aware of this bug. It's a little bit of a deep cut, but we also knew about it internally, and I was friends with the designer who was in charge of that quest and had failed to kill that bug, and it was always a mark of shame on his soul that there was a quest out there that you couldn't complete. So when it came around time for us to do the Shadow Broker DLC for Mass Effect 2, the cinematic design team, after you beat the DLC, you can go to the Shadow Broker's computer and look at these dossiers, and there's these little videos that you can watch, and it's just like, you know, 20 just like weird nonsensical shots of characters doing things. And if you know the lore, like, there's something, most of them, like, they're a callback to something. And one I did was, there's a shot, and again, if you don't know about this bug, it makes zero sense, but there's a shot of a keeper in a very small room with no doors, looking like they're at the bottom of an elevator shaft, and they're just turning and kind of like patting the walls.
That's amazing.
Yeah, oh, and that was, that was my homage to my friend's missing keeper.
That's amazing. That's so great. That poor keeper just stuck in a room without any doors.
Just he fell down a ventilation shaft or something, and nobody knows where they are. They're just stuck there for eternity.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So on the topic of favorite memories, do you have any other, in general, favorite memories from your time there?
I mean, there were a lot of great ones. The dev team was so great, so passionate, and full of really awesome people. One thing that has very, very little to do with Mass Effect, but at that point in time, when Team Fortress 2 came out, everybody loved that game. Inside the BioWare studio, there were a bunch of us that started playing against each other, like, you know, forming teams and getting competitive about things. Then somebody got contacted from a developer at another studio and said that they were really into Team Fortress 2 and they'd formed a team. Did they want to play? And it turned into, over Facebook, this entire game developer league of something like at least 24 studios formed teams. And we had like a full bracket. There was an underground Team Fortress 2 game developer fight club for 2 years, where like LucasArts and Red 5 and Valve joined in. And all these different teams, all these different studios, Blizzard and everybody formed teams. Then we would go at each other in what we call the Studio Rumble. And again, it was a full bracket with a championship and everything. And we did like two seasons of that. And it was a great way to get to know devs across the industry. And then beat the hell out of them in Team Fortress 2. Valve won season one, but BioWare, we won. It was season two or season three. We were the champions, and it was a fantastic experience.
That's so cool. Yeah,
probably nobody really knows about.
What was your go-to character?
I was a medic. Again, I told you my brother got hired with me, so he was the heavy, and heavy medics are.
So you were the pair, yeah.
That's, yeah. So we were kind of the anchors of the BioWare team.
So are you breaking the first rule of Team Fortress Game Dev Fight Club by talking about?
It's been gone for long enough that I don't think anybody will be too upset. I think we even recorded some of the matches because we would go back and analyze them to figure out, you know, how to beat Valve or whatever team just kicked our teeth in. So there's some recordings out there of a lot of game devs swearing at each other while playing Team Fortress 2.
I'm just imagining Gabe Newell as Tyler Durden, and it's great. I know that you're a gamer too. I think you've posted about it some things here and there on Twitter. What kind of games do you play in your off time?
I do play a lot of games. That's one of the reasons I got in the industry. I've always loved games. I have put in an unconscionable amount of hours into the Total War series. Total War, Warhammer 1, 2, and 3, definitely great. I play a lot of XCOM, the very, very original one and the new ones. And I also play, right now I'm doing a playthrough of Witcher 3, because it is an amazing game. And the downside of working at BioWare was that all the games I worked on, the 6 BioWare games, they're all tainted for me, because I worked on them. I know all of them, about everything about them. They're no fun to play for me. Companies that do the same type of work, it's always a joy to play their stuff, because it's, you know, getting to experience that type of content, knowing nothing about it and just going in as a player and a fan, and it's utterly delightful.
I was going to ask, you know, with you having virtually all of the spoilers for Mass Effect, have you ever played through Mass Effect?
I got to play through Mass Effect 1 as a fan. Again, that came out right after I got hired. So I got to play through that cold, knowing nothing. But the other ones I did play through. Mass Effect 2 I played through before it went gold, when we were in the final testing phase, after all the content was done. So I got to play through that. A lot of the other, all 3 Dragon Ages and Mass Effect 3, I've actually never finished myself in my off time. Because I know everything about them. I know all the twists. I know all the turns. And especially when you get to the level that you worked on specifically and have put hundreds of hours into just that one level, you have no desire to play that level again any more than you would just to stare at the wall in front of you for a couple hours. So usually I'll play through the other people's content, and when I get to my content, I'm like, all right, that's where my save game stops, and just have to walk away.
Now, you made jokes like the keeper stuck in the elevator shaft. You made jokes about your coworker's work. Did anyone ever make jokes about yours that you noticed later?
Not that I know of. The only thing that came close, kind of, and it wasn't even specifically my work. It was just kind of the piece of content in general. But in Mass Effect Andromeda, there is actually a Morden callback that didn't. It didn't end up ship. Well, it shipped in one version. But what happened was a writer had written a little tiny side quest where writer can go and ingest a psychedelic herb or something. And then they go on a little bit of a trip. And I think it's Sam, the AI in their head, starts singing Scientist Solarian to them eventually. As part of the trip. And I got pinged by the designer who was working on that planet right at the end of the project. I had no idea it was in there. And they said, hey, did you know there's a Morden thing in here? I know you're the Morden guy. And I was like, I had no idea. Somebody wrote that in. So I went, and it had been designed as an ambient dialogue, which just means there's no cinematic camera. You just click on the character and the gameplay camera, and they give a couple lines, and then some audio plays. And so I went in there and I was like, oh, I can't just leave this as an ambient. So I actually made all the cinematic parts of it and made it so after writer ingests the herb, like you get a little flash into their eyes, and then it cuts away to this this Solarian with their back to you, facing out over a pool, which is the closest thing I could find to a beach on the level where this took place. And so there was, data miners have found a little scene where you can see Solarian from the back, who kind of looks like Morden, but is not, because he's got his horns, and we didn't have a Morden model for that. But that was at least a little poking fun at myself. It's like, oh, maybe Morden worked on Sam as well. Who knows?
that's awesome. I never knew that's you worked on that scene. I've seen that scene. And modders, I believe, have re-implemented that if you're playing Andromeda on PC. So about Mass Effect 1, since I know you played that one, and part of 2, do you play Paragon or Renegade or Mix?
I always go Renegade. Not because I'm an evil person much. But I always found this, even from, you know, like Knights of the Old Republic and that, I always just found that all the evil options are usually the most interesting visually. And this is something we struggled with, internally at BioWare, was, you know, you can make a lot of like Paragon interrupts. But it's an interrupt has to be an action that has to, like, you have to click a button and something happens. And that's pretty easy for Renegade stuff. You know, you punch somebody, you shoot somebody, you do like an aggressive action. For Paragon, that's harder. It's like, all right, what's a positive physical thing I can do? I'm gonna hug Tally is a Paragon interrupt. But we really struggled, you know, finding ways to make that interesting content for the good stuff. Because it's just harder to come up with what that is. And so that always kind of made me gravitate towards the Renegade stuff, because it was usually more visually exciting, more dramatic. And yeah, you would, you know, get to punch an NPC or something.
Yeah. A lot of actors will say that it's more fun to play an evil character than a good character, probably for similar reasons. It's just more colorful.
Yeah, you get to chew a lot more scenery.
Yeah.
On the cinematic note, I was actually just talking about this on another podcast, the Two Girls, One Ship podcast. When it comes to subtle actions and nonverbal communication in romance in real life versus how we see it in Mass Effect, and how dialogue had to carry a lot of weight because it seemed like the engine didn't permit displaying a lot of these very subtle nonverbal things that human beings do when flirting with each other, but you couldn't possibly depict that in the game as effectively. Is that something that you ever ran into?
Oh, absolutely. And facial animation was always, for the cinematic design team, a lot of it was done procedurally. Like there's basically a robot that we say, hey, this is an angry line. And we've, you know, made some facial animations and some stuff. And the robot would just say, okay, yeah, the eyebrows are going to do this and that. And we could go in there and tweak that a bit and make it unique. But even the facial models, yeah, like, you know, they didn't have a lot of control. And even if they had, frankly, we didn't have the time to go in there and really finesse a lot of that stuff. Again, we were trying to put out content in bulk. And you had to paint with a broad brush, and that always started with the body and the staging. And if you were lucky, you got time to go in and tweak some facial stuff. But yeah, between that and the technical limitations at the time, yeah, we just were absolutely not able to give realistic facial performances to the extent that we can now with performance capture and the technology that's available these days. Right now, you can, you know, basically take one-to-one a fantastic actor's performance on the stage when I'm directing them, and it's, you know, blows anything we did on Mass Effect 1, 2, and 3 out of the water just because of the tech constraints.
Yeah, but you know what? You guys did a job well enough with the tools you had that it really does stand up, and it conveys a lot of the emotion and the feelings. Otherwise, people wouldn't respond so positively. So for the limitations you had, I think you did a stellar job.
Yeah, there's still new players, by the way. I'm still meeting people who have never played Mass Effect before, and they're getting into it. And they're falling in love with it. So I think that says a lot.
It holds up even all these years later, which is, you know, that's hard to do.
Yeah, no. And again, also a huge, huge amount of that, I'm sure, goes out to the folks who worked on the Legendary Edition and really polished up a lot of that content for the current generation. And yeah, I even bought it. I'm hoping to go through and play through it myself once, you know, time has dulled some of the knowledge I have inside the trilogy. It looks fantastic, and we certainly tried our best, and I think a lot of it still holds up.
So we're getting to the end of the episode. We have to ask you, speaking about the end of things, which ending do you prefer?
I always want everybody to get along. I would always go with Synthesis. And I know there's some moral questions about you making that choice.
You go Renegade, but Synthesis.
Yep. Interesting. I do. And, you know, I would never go full Renegade. Like I wouldn't shoot Morden or anything, but, you know, I'd be a pretty, pretty rough and tumble, chef. I'd be bad cop, but yes, at the end of the day, I want you know, peace and harmony for the universe. That's what it's all about.
He's rough around the edges, but he's got a heart of gold.
Do you donuts too? You like donuts?
You're a liability to the whole department, but you get the job done.
Exactly.
Well, this has been so enlightening, such an enjoyable conversation. Thank you, John, for joining us. Is there anything else you'd like to share before we wrap up the episode?
No. Again, just, thanks for having me. More than happy to, give a little peek behind the curtain. It's not something game devs to get a chance to do that often. And yeah, just so happy and appreciative again for everybody who has enjoyed the work the entire team did. I have zero knowledge about forthcoming Mass Effects, but I am certainly enthused and really, really psyched about what the team's doing there. I have a few former colleagues who have are working on it. And I'm just really, really looking forward to what the franchise has in the future.
Yeah, we're excited that the series is continuing too. So we're looking forward to that as well. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for being here. I know our listeners will very much enjoy the insight and the stories that you were able to share with us today. Sam, we got to wrap this up, buddy. Anything else you want to share?
Yeah, well, John, yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on. And like you said, giving us that peek behind the curtain that we as players, you know, on the other side of things, we as players so rarely get. And I think that especially for people who listen to this podcast, there's a great demand for that. So we always love learning, you know, more and more about how our favorite game was produced. So thank you again for coming on.
My absolute pleasure.
And I'm, for our listeners, if you want to stop by my streams, I'm streaming. I did take the past weekend off, and I will be taking this weekend off because of Emerald City Con. But if you give me a follow at In7 The Legend on Twitch, I'll be streaming the conclusion to Mass Effect 2 for my Neutral Shepherd playthrough. Now, John, I don't know if you knew I was doing this, but I'm doing a Neutral Shepherd playthrough where I'm intentionally trying to not pick anything too extreme. I'm not doing any interrupts. And it also means that he's very apathetic. So it means that he's not doing any of the side missions because that would be extra work. And
he's the most lazy and dangerous man in the universe.
Is this mildly depressed Shepherd? Is that what we're?
It's completely apathetic. Like, I don't know if you watched Futurama, but it's like the apathy people in Futurama. And he's a little bit disappointed he was brought back from the dead. So he
I think we all would be.
he's Seattle Shepherd. No, I'm kidding. He is very much just wanting to be done with it. So I am 11 hours into Mass Effect 2 and I'm about to finish it, which is not how the game I think was meant to be played.
It's like almost a speed run. What the heck?
It's almost a speed run, but it is Neutral Shepherd. I've marketed it to people who watch me on Twitch as the least compelling gameplay you'll ever see because the dialogue is meant to be as neutral and reasonable as possible. So I'm doing that on Saturdays, and then I'm also streaming Mass Effect Andromeda on Thursdays. Sorry, no gimmick for the Andromeda one. but people, if they'd like to chat with me, can find me on Twitter at N7 The Legend as well.
Yeah, go check out Sam's streams. They're awesome. Also, if you've been playing The Witcher like John has, you can check out The Witcher Lorecast or any of my other Lorecast shows that I do over on robotsradio.net. Go check out all of that stuff. Lots of great shows for me and the other creators on the network. So if you're looking for more content, you can find stuff there. And John, thank you again for joining us. And Sam, of course, for being here. And chat, thank you for joining us for the live feed. We appreciate everybody being part of the show and helping support us and keep this thing going. We really do appreciate you. So that's going to do it for this week. We'll be back next week. And until then, stay safe out there in the galaxy. We'll see you guys later. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to the Mass Effect Lorecast. We'd love to hear your opinion and thoughts on the lore of Mass Effect. Reach out to us on Twitter at Mass Effect Cast, or check out the Robots Radio Discord. Also, you can send us an email at masseffectlorecast@gmail.com.